got you. I'm all ready. Hi, everybody. It's Phil Parr coming into your homes again with this year's Blind Like Me. We are starting another year inaugurating. This will be probably run around the first of the year, somewhere around then. So we'll say Happy New Year to everybody. Our guest is Blake Lindsay from Dallas. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Phil. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. It's cold up there this morning.
It is 23 degrees in Dallas, Texas. We are not used to that, but it's very exhilarating. You step outside and, by gum, it wakes you up.
Yeah, but
it really does.
You don't want to stay out there long. You want to get back into the warmth of your little cocoon. I do.
You're not kidding.
I do. My dogs are very happy about it. They're running and jumping and chasing.
That's a little frisky today.
Huh? Oh, they're just chasing each other. Well, as you can tell, and it's very obvious that that you are a trained announcer. That comes across very, very, very obviously.
Well, I had a 22-year broadcast career, Phil, and I really had a lot of opportunities to do what I wanted to do. And with it, I had to do a lot of other jobs at the same time in most cases. A lot of it was part-time, but it was usually in a medium or a major market where I got the best experience and got to work with the real pros. And so it was a blast. It's something I wanted to do. When I was 8 years old, I already knew that I wanted to be a disc jockey on the radio and play the hits.
Yeah, those usually come early. What do you think about it? You were totally blind, Blake?
Yes, I've been totally blind in both eyes since I was 10 months old, so I have zero recollection of ever having sight at all, which I think is, at least in my case, a good thing. You know, I don't ever miss something that I don't remember having.
That's true. And if you never had it, there's no way you're going to miss it. What I think, when we've talked about this several times, that radio or sound or audio or listening to things is just it's as natural for us to gravitate to that as it would be for a sighted kid to want to be a baseball player, you know?
Absolutely. And communication, you know, verbal communication is something that we're always pros. I've never talked to a blind person that I couldn't understand every syllable. even if they've got an impediment. I mean, it's just easy to communicate. We don't make eye contact, but we make a lot of verbal contact, a lot of expression.
We do, and you can. And I'm sure you the same thing. I find that I'm as good a judge of persons as is my wife or other people I might be around. I can tell as much by voice what sort of person they are.
Yes, especially after, you know, the second time you meet them. Obviously, the first time we should never get an impression, even though I always do, you know. But by the second or third time, you certainly have a good judge of their character and a lot of things about them.
I think everybody does first impressions. Yes. All right, when you were a small child and they realized that you were totally blind, what did they think? What did they do? Where did this happen? Tell us about your early childhood.
Well, it was very interesting because my dad was 25 and mom was 26, and they were both college graduates, very intelligent people, but they had never been exposed to blind people in their life, never been around any, and mom noticed a cloud around my eyes and that I wasn't quite as alert as I used to be with eating. I've always had a good appetite, I still do, and but I was starting to be hesitant because of the fact that I couldn't see the spoon coming. And, you know, mom thought, what in the world? So they were very concerned, and they took me to several specialists and detached retina. They heard from one specialist, and just a variety of wrong answers. And finally, somebody knew that I had a retinoblastoma, which was very uncommon and certainly still is. They've done a lot of research on it, but it's a cancerous tumor that sets in, and they got to act quickly. Obviously, it's that close to your brain. It's your eyeball level, your retinas.
Yeah.
And so certainly they had to act very quickly. They removed my right eye when I was 9 months old, and then my left eye just a month later, and they couldn't save either eye. Now, my parents, being the kind of people that they were each willing to give one of their eyes to help restore both of mine, and that was not going to be a success, but they certainly were very voluntary with that, and I've gotten confirmation from people, so I know they're not just telling me a story years later, and I didn't even know that till I was 17, and maybe that was a good time for me to hear that, because I realized how deep their love was to, you know, be that young, and you think of being 25 years old and being willing to forfeit one of your good eyes for your son.
Yeah,
that's pretty amazing. And so mom and dad were somehow instinctively prepared, you know, I believe by our Heavenly Father, because at that maturity level in my life, I was still acting like a kid somewhat. I was working very hard, but what a contribution and a sacrifice both, potentially. And So it was pretty amazing. They finally got the right answer, retinoblastoma, and I've learned that just very few people have retinoblastoma. It was very frustrating, again, because they had to go to so many specialists to find the final answer, and thank goodness it wasn't too late. I love being alive, and, you know, it was a matter of life or death at that point.
And this is something that happened to you at you, I think you said, 10 months old. So up until 10 months old, you, as far as we know, had normal sight.
Yes, I had very normal sight. It began to be a little bit cloudy, I understand, at 9 months old, where they could observe that I was looking more toward the sun to get that satisfaction of feeling the heat, being able to see the light. So it was obvious that my sight was dimming very quickly. And I wasn't old enough to talk until I was about 12, 13 months, started spitting out some words as a little blind baby. But at that point, I was completely blind, of course, when I began to talk and walk. So literally all of my memorable life, and then my memory goes back vividly to when I was 3 years old, so I cannot remember at all what it was like being blind. And amazingly, people say, well, would you like to be hypnotized so you could try to remember? It's like, no, not particularly.
No, I don't think I'll pass on that. But this thing, if left unchecked, would have taken your life.
Absolutely would have. There's a 100% chance of that.
And
before I was a year old, I probably would have died at least by the time I was a year, because cancer spreads, as we know, very quickly.
Yeah.
And when it's already as close to your brain as your retina, you're right on top of it.
And no explanation by anyone as to why this happened to a newborn baby?
No explanation except retinoblastoma. I've had a couple of friends at the Indiana School for the Blind where I graduated. 1982. I graduated from public school, but I went there through my sophomore year in high school. I only had one other friend who had retinoblastoma, actually two, and then one of them was a little boy who I never got to know very well. He's a lawyer now, too, the little boy with retinoblastoma. He lost both of his eyes as well. So out of hundreds of people, the blind school usually has about 200 people, K through 12, and of course people were graduating every year, but my full 12 years at the blind school, I met exactly two with retinoblastoma out of hundreds of people. So it's not a common occurrence. You hear a lot about prematurity. You hear about different things. But the retinoblastoma cancerous tumor was brand new in 1965 when they discovered that with me. And it wasn't brand new, but certainly they didn't know much about it. So my parents never had any of this running in their family. You know, if you go 150 years back.
Yeah.
In our family tree, there was no evidence of that happening. So it was very unique, and there was really no explanation for it at all. And that's, my parents really handled it quite well, you know, in that consideration that they had zero knowledge about it. Nobody in their families ever had it. And, you know, the fact that they had the expectations for my life that they did, and they wanted me to be a goal setter and achiever, is pretty amazing to me. Now, had they known blind people and what they could do, and, of course, we all... You know, Helen Keller had already made a huge name for herself, and Annie Sullivan, who trained her and was her great teacher. But Helen Keller was obviously a blazing example for everybody. She passed away in 1968, so I'm sure that Mom and Dad knew about her. And then Stevie Wonder had already made a name for himself in 1964 or 5, you know, when this happened. He had already had several songs, Ray Charles. So, you know, they knew at a musician level that blind people were doing things.
But if they had really known blind people, we know just as many failures as we do successes. We know lots of people who can't handle blindness. Obviously, you can. You alluded to the fact that you were raised up north, up in where, Indiana, did you say?
Yes, I was, until 1983 is when I moved to Austin, Texas. I had heard about crystal rehabilitation. And the reason I moved to Texas is Mom and Dad had moved here in 1982. My dad had taken a job in 1980-81 with Zig Ziglar Corporation, and my dad was the vice president and did a lot of writing, wrote the ICANN program and several things for Zig, but Zig wanted him to move down here, and I refused to. I was being the rebellious kiddo in high school. I had just transitioned, made a big transition from the blind school to a public school by something that I wanted to do, and my parents did as well. They thought that would be a good time in my life to be exposed to the real excited world that I was going to be working in the rest of my life. And
okay,
so I didn't really want to move to Texas because I'd only been in the public school for 1 year. I'd already made a ton of friends. It was very unique for the public school kids to be around a blind kid for the first time in their life. So we had a lot of fun, a lot of practical jokes, but it was good fun, clean humor. And so I had already, you know, established myself. It was a small high school that graduated 150 students a year. So I'm glad it wasn't one of those that graduates 1,000 students a year. I really felt like I fit in.
Yeah.
And I went from 15 students in a grade to 150. So I multiplied it by 10. And the biggest challenge I had was memorizing everybody's voice and name, because they're so big into that. Who am I? Who am I? That's one of the first games that they love to play. They think it's so cool when you remember their voice and their name with it.
Now, but let's talk a little about the Indiana School for the Blind. I don't think we've had anyone on who attended that school. What was it like, dormitory setting as a child, or how did you? You went there at age 6, I suppose, and they began teaching you Braille. Tell us about Indiana School for the Blind.
I'd love to, because I really have good memories of the Indiana School for the Blind. When I was 5 years old, I started at a kindergarten level, and it seemed like a long day, because we started at 8 a.m. in the morning. I guess a.m. does mean morning, doesn't it? But I started at 8 a.m. until 3:30 p.m. With an hour off for lunch, but it was a pretty lengthy, rigorous day for the most part. Mm-hmm. We learned introductory Braille at the kindergarten level, but really just kind of dabbled in it. We played a lot of educational games. We had a lot of fun and read a lot of stories, where we'd huddle around and sit Indian style on the rug. There were 10 people, I believe, in my kindergarten class. And that was an opportunity for the very first time in my life to be around anybody who was sightless. Prior to 5 years old, I'd never met any blind boy or girl in my life. And so that was a neat opportunity, because we all at least shared that commonality, and we were all learning together. Now, when I was 6 years old in the first grade, Mrs. Pomerlin was my homeroom teacher, and she taught us Braille. And she used the illustration of, at least in my case, I was having a difficult time learning Braille, the little engine that could, she really kept illustrating that, and I was very into engines at that point in my life. So that's one that educators love to refer to often, because it's such a good little story on that, how this little tiny engine was able to pull the big train up the hill, because of his level of motivation. I think I can, and just working your way up. Well, I learned Braille. I was a little bit blurry about a certain, like, for example, S's look like P's. Only it's missing dot one if it's an S. You're missing your dot one, but P, you're filling in that top left. And so S's felt like P's, M's kind of felt like N's. I mean, there were certain letters that felt pretty close to each other, obviously, because it's just one dot difference. And so my second grade teacher, Mrs. Davidson, learned which letters were fooling me the most often and put those together and showed me the difference, and that really made all the difference. I learned Braille. And Louis Braille, now that I look back, and I've felt this way for a long time, what a phenomenon he is, because I read a lot of Braille books in my life. I've taken a lot of Braille notes in my life, and I don't know how I could have done it without. I just think it's amazing that he came up with that concept. I know that he had some help, but what a phenomenon and what a help for us in the blind schools. The Indiana School for the Blind had a lot of not only great academics because of the one-on-one, I should say one-on-ten, per classroom pretty much, a lot of those kids end up going to college, because of that. They're smart. They've had one-on-one, and so it's really, really helped them to grow quickly academically. But we also had great sports. We had wrestling. We had swimming. We had track. A lot of neat things for the blind school, and they were very used to teaching blind kids. And they, too, had high expectations. I think if I would have gone to that public school at that time of my life, I would have been waived on a lot of things. I wouldn't have had to have gotten an opportunity to do a lot of the harder things that I had to do at the blind school, because they had high expectations and they wanted us to be achievers. So sometimes if you go to public school early on, they just help you through it, and they don't let you do it. And it's because they feel sorry for you. But when I transitioned to public school, it was my junior year in high school. And by then I wanted to encourage others. I already learned that having a unique challenge like being totally blind was an opportunity for me to really encourage other students to excel and do as well as they possibly could.
Yeah. But you were a full-time student there. You didn't go home at night. You moved. You went from your parents' home to the blind school and stayed there all year. I mean, you stayed there till Thanksgiving and came home.
Initially, I was very fortunate, and I loved Mom's cooking. She was an excellent cook, and we only lived 13 miles away from the Indiana School of the Blind. So my first couple of years there, I went home every night. Now, by the time I was 8 years old, there were more and more activities that I loved being involved with. And so I gradually moved into being a night student, like most of the students were. There were very few day students because most of the people, most of the blind kids did not live in the Indianapolis area. They lived about everywhere but. They lived in Lafayette, Indiana, which is 65 miles away. They lived in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is 120. So we had kids really from ranging from, you know, 50 miles away all the way to 150 miles away. And I lived 13, and so I really, I think kids were occasionally jealous of me, my kindergarten year especially, as it really wasn't all that much fun to stay there, yet there were very few activities. However, by the time you're 10 and 12 and 13 and 14, the recreation is just fun. You don't even want to go home except for, you know, the weekends and Thanksgiving. And I loved my family a lot, but certainly they made it a very fun and worthwhile place to be in the Indiana School for the Blind. It was a nice big building, and I often dream 30 years later about walking down those hallways. You know, it was just a very good memory for me. And when we went to I'll explain the Shriners in our Indianapolis area, the Shrining Circus, they would want us to feel the elephants and feel the animals sometimes.
Yeah.
And since these animals were extremely tame, that was one of the best times of my life as well, is going to the circus every year, and we'd actually get to feel an elephant, and I get to ride on an elephant's back. And my cousin Joey always told me I had an elephant's memory. So I finally got to feel what an elephant was like and got to ride on the elephant. And she had a baby also, a 500-pound, three-week-old elephant that I got to feel. So we really got a complete concept of what that was all about. And if I would have gone to a public school, I would not have gotten that opportunity, most likely.
But you reversed the procedure. You were a day student, and then you decided you didn't want to be a day student. You wanted to stay there with your buds at night.
That's right.
Well, that's really very nice because, you know, all our experiences at blind schools were different. Mine was not good. Yours was. We talked to people every week, some who've gone to public school and had a wonderful, who wouldn't have it any other way. Some who have gone and we've talked to people who went to public school and felt completely isolated, especially in high school because the boys and girls didn't have any idea how to treat a blind child. But obviously your childhood and your blind school experience was very positive from I gather.
Very positive for a lot of reasons. Again, the expectation level of the teachers and our administration, our principal, our superintendent, you know, by the time I got there, they were seasoned pros. I wasn't with any amateurs at all. They expected things of me and expected me to perform in the dormitories that I lived in when I was a night student, to take the trash out or whatever my chore was. We all divided up the chores, and we cleaned up the place. Even though we had a janitorial staff that did a fantastic job, we were expected to do certain things as we grew. And so it was just a real opportunity for me at the blind school to be able to be challenged. And at the public school, I don't think that I would have been as much. Now, again, by the time I was a junior in high school, I wanted to be. Yeah. Plus, I wanted to be an inspiration for those who had obstacles in life. I had a kid in my class. His name was Rick Watkins, who turned out to be one of my very best friends in public school. He was a below-average student because he couldn't stand school. He's very rebellious. But he was my best Braille student because he thought it was so unique and so cool to learn Braille that not only did I teach him grade 1 Braille, and he learned that in a week or less, he wanted to learn grade 2 Braille because I told him about, you know, the difference. And so he said, I want to learn grade 2 Braille, you know, the BLE sign, the ATION sign.
Mm-hmm.
The whole Scooby-Doo, and before I knew it, man, he was writing all kinds of Braille notes.
And was he a blind person?
No.
Or he was sighted?
He was a sighted kid, very cocky. He was a lot of fun. You know, at that point in my life, I was 17 years old, and I liked a rebellious person. You know, he was very, very vocal. But he was a hoot to be around.
Uh-huh.
Really enjoyed him a lot. And Rick took on the Braille so quickly and so eagerly that I realized that he was overcoming, he didn't realize it, but he was overcoming a big obstacle that a lot of people have. I didn't like Braille at first myself. I resisted it, but realized that I had to learn it, and then it came naturally to me, and I had a blast teaching sighted people how to read Braille and how to write Braille because they loved it. It was like a foreign language to them that they picked up, and once they mastered it, it was a triumphant feeling for them as well.
Well, was this young man, the sighted person that you taught Braille, was he able to parlay that into a career? I mean, is he now teaching blind people or helping blind people or not?
You know, I haven't talked to him in years.
Oh, really?
I don't believe so.
Really?
I don't believe that he did.
Yeah, because
it really taught me a lesson, because he was pretty much a C-minus kind of student, but he was an A-plus Braille student. So when you set your mind to something, you can really reach in and you know, give it your gusto. He was really a smart kid, but he was a below-average student because he just didn't like the academics. He wasn't challenged in his mind. He felt them to be pretty useless. But then when I came along, and I think that I want all your listeners to hear this, and I say it all the time, is when you have a unique challenge, you can really inspire everybody, because they look at you as somebody who I can. If you have that I can and I will attitude, and you're around you know, just normal people, you're going to really inspire more than you have any clue. I mean, I didn't even realize that much until 15 years ago, and now I'm very focused on how much inspiration I can provide, just because I'm a uniquely challenged person.
Now,
a lot of people don't like to call it a physical challenge. It's absolutely not a mental challenge. But you know what? It's a very unique challenge. People have a hard time relating with you, but if they see that you're a positive person and willing to get out there and try to accomplish things, it's very impressive in the workplace.
Obviously, the food was edible at your Indiana School for the Blind.
That's about exactly what it was. I don't want to give it any more credit than that.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, that was part of the reason I wanted to be a day student as long as I did.
Oh yeah, for mama's cooking.
Absolutely.
Okay, but now did you say freshman, sophomore, when did you decide that public school would be a good thing for you?
Well, I decided really, I guess about my freshman year in high school. I got into radio at the J. Everett Light Career Center. And I realized that, you know, I like being around sighted people because I get a chance to inspire them, and it's the real world. It's the world that I'm going to be working in here in a few years.
What is this J. Everett? What is that? What is this center that you...
It was a huge career center that we had a lot of opportunity with. It was 3 miles away from the school. And North Central High School is a huge nearby school in the Washington Township in Indianapolis. And they had an enormous career center with anything from heating and air conditioning to small engines, to big engines, to auto, you know, just the whole thing. We had body repair people. They had a huge shop that, you know, you could take an old beat-up car and they'd fix it up and get it back in mint condition. And then they had an awesome radio and TV department. And WJEL was the call letters of our station. It was at 126 watts of power. It covered most of the city fairly well, even at that low power. We had a good tower. And we were able to learn top 40 radio and the mechanics and how to do things and cue records. At that time, we were spinning records with these powerful turntables. They were pretty amazing, you know, just less than a fourth of a turn, you know, behind the beginning of the song, and boom. So as soon as you hit the button, it was instantaneous. Everybody's always talking about CDs and hard drives, and really turntables were actually almost more fun. You had to be very responsive. As soon as your record was over and you did your break, you had to queue up another record and always, you know, be one ahead of yourself. It really made you stay alert. But the Career Center offered a huge opportunity for me to learn that career that I always wanted to, radio. And so I realized that, hey, I like this public school environment. I really enjoy being around these people. And they like me, too, and I'm an inspiration to them. And so it was very challenging for both of us. It was a win-win, and I decided public school would be fun at that point. I think that I really, you know, and I don't feel this way now, but at that time I was kind of hopeful of marrying a sighted female so that I could see the world through her eyes, basically. And so I really wanted to marry a sighted person, and I knew that at the blind school that there were, you know, a lot of low vision students, and I considered them sighted because they could see so well.
Yeah.
But that I was going to have complete opportunity in a public school with the sighted world. And I don't feel that way now. I just want to let you know that I've known a lot of people very, you know, blind, and they have a very successful, you know, parenting and everything. There's a couple of pairs here up in Dallas-Fort Worth that I just love like family. Jack Hickman, Jack and Kelly Hickman, they've done a wonderful job of raising a son who's ahead of his time because he's had more responsibilities put on him at a younger age because he had totally blind parents. He knew how to write a check when he was 10 years old and do a lot of other things.
Yeah. Now, this career center was for what? It was for all students, or for low-achieving students, or for handicapped students, or what was it? What was its purpose?
It was for all students who wanted to take on a brand-new career. You know, we had anything, again, from heating and air conditioning on through just tons of careers for people to learn. It was a vocational career center for people that didn't want to go to college, basically, that were still in high school and wanted to take a trade, wanted to learn a new trade, and they had the best trainers around to teach whatever career it was that you were interested in.
And they had a little FM radio station.
Yes. So a lot of people that graduated from high school were already good enough that they had a commercial radio career immediately,
yeah,
or that they were able to find jobs in whatever career they got into from that vocational career center. Didn't have to go to college to learn a trade, but that FM station taught me how to be a commercial disc jockey because I had a real good mentor that really wanted to treat it like a commercial radio station. He didn't let us slack. We had to back time the network at the top of the hour.
Yeah.
The different things that we had to do that sounded very professional.
Now, this was in the early 80s. Am I right or not?
Yes, I got in the summer of 79, and I was a freshman in high school at that point. And I was there until 1982, 83 was my very last year at the J. Everett Light Career Center, and I was the program director my last year there.
So you're right. Everything was records, and we did our production was done on tapes.
Yes.
And you had cart machines there?
Yep, exactly. They looked like 8-track tapes. They were a continuous loop, and they had a little wire thing in them that helped them to stop. We had what's called a terse tone at that time is what we called it. It was a silent tone that you could not hear, of course, and it would stop the cart machine. And so that way it was queued up to play again without fail. Pretty amazing that they were able to make them completely stop in time, you know, to be perfectly queued up the next time you needed it.
The reason you couldn't hear that tone is it was on another track.
Yes.
It was
a silent, very silent track, and it, very seldom could you ever hear that tone. It was a mistake.
But if the heads were out of line, occasionally you heard that little thousand cycle. Yes, I'm quite familiar with cart machines.
I bet you are.
I hate them. They're horrible. They're archaic technology. I have a 3-stack. I'll send it to you.
Okay. I know by the 1980s, you know, if your heads were aligned, though, they were pretty amazing. They were they were definitely something that I remember when we converted from records to cards, we had good card machines. And when we made that conversion, we were so proud of ourselves. You know, we were really high-tech now. We were cards. And we were required to keep the heads clean.
Yep.
And they sounded very good. You know, to me, they sounded about as good as CDs do, depending on the kind of cartridge you use and all that. But CDs were a lot more convenient. And now hard drives, I remember when hard drives first came out, they sounded kind of gurgly. And, you know, just a lot of bad things would happen. The hard drive would go down.
Not anymore.
The last 6 years have been phenomenal. I mean, just flawless.
You always had that cart, that one cart that was a little bit out of phase in the record sort of sounded. You got that little little switching noise.
Our mentor was real hard with us on that as well, though. And those are things that he really cracked the whip on, making certain that as soon as something got out of phase, by gum, we had to get back in there and record it again and not let that happen. But you're right.
Recart that song. If you dropped the cart, you were in trouble.
That's right.
Okay, so you learned radio there and obviously learned it well, and you felt like you could make a living doing radio, and you decided, much against your will, to move from Indiana to hot Texas.
And it was hot. I moved in June. I had the hottest 3 months of the year ahead of me when I moved.
And this was to Austin, and it was just like hell. I mean, it was 115 every day, as it is.
Not only that, but no breeze. At least in Dallas-Fort Worth, we get a nice breeze in the summer. Very good breeze. But I remember taking mobility the summer of 1983 in Austin and learning how to walk around Austin, and they had a good bus system, and so it was a real fun educational experience. I got very good at the buses, but man, was it hot.
But Austin can be a difficult town in that it has lots of steps and lots of hills. And it does.
I was pretty much in North Austin, you know, where Chris Cole is, and it wasn't as hill country as South Austin, around Ben White. You know, they have a lot of, it's beautiful hill country. Austin's a really a neat town, but there's just so many people there now. It was a city really that was built for 350,000 people, and they have over a million now.
Yeah, it's
very
Austin,
consolidated.
Austin goes, North Austin goes up to Taylor and Round Rock and almost to Dallas, almost to Waco, seems like.
Maybe not quite, but you're right. It has really grown. definitely to Georgetown, that's for sure.
I did a lot of walking around Austin, and I lived there. Well, I went to school there, school for the blind there, and then I thought I wanted to live there afterwards and walked around. And it has lots of steps in Austin, and it's not a cane traveler's nightmare, but it's a little more difficult than, say, Houston or someplace like that. So you got to Austin, you moved in with you were living with your parents. How did you get your first radio job?
Well, I was excited about K98 as soon as I got in town. That station was just smoking. They were top 40. They were the only top 40 station in town. And it just happened that a lot of people passed through there that were from Houston, that were from Dallas-Fort Worth. And Austin was kind of a stepping market at that point. You're either going up or you're going down. So we had a lot of good talent that went through there, and I was surrounded by what I call great mentors. Worked with a guy, Dave Jarrett. And he learned, he taught me, I should say, I learned.
I know him.
How to really make blind fun on the radio. How to not to be a blind guy, but to be an Alice Hyde guy. And then to really poke fun at it, but not go over the top, not make it hideous, but to really have a lot of fun blind humor and to be able to go out on the remotes and hear people say, hey, you know what, you don't sound blind.
How do blind people
hear that a lot?
How do blind people sound? I don't know.
Yeah, so I, of course, would start swaying my head side to side and say, well, will this work, you know? So, a little Stevie Wonder, but...
Dave Garrett and probably Barry Kay, was he there?
I got to work with Barry Kay. At that time, he wasn't there, but he did go through K98 in Austin and B93, a couple of stations that I worked. We did get to cross paths, and one of my favorite jocks, Barry Kay, still is. He works in Conroe now. He's kind of on his way down, which is a shame, because he's still
really,
great ball of talent.
It's really not Conroe. That station covers Houston very nicely. And he's at, it's a, let's see, 107.5, I believe.
No, actually, he's working at a station that is right around Conroe. It's, what was it, 90, I should know, Star Country is what they call it.
Oh, is he? He's not at 97.5 anymore. He's at Star Country now.
He worked at KLDE for years.
He did.
And that was on 94.5, and they transitioned to 107.5. They were bought, and they had to do kind of a swap.
Well, Clear Channel bought the 94.5, and they didn't want to play that oldies music. That's not a viable format anymore. I mean, it's not. You can play that oldies music, and you can get some audience, but everybody's tired of hearing the Shirelles, you know?
Yeah. That's
people,
right. So even 107.5 covered the marketplace very well. But where Barry ended up about a year and a half ago, they just cover, you know, pretty much the Conroe side.
Yeah, I know the one he's talking about. It's 95.7 maybe, 97.
I'm thinking 95.7. I'll look him up, of course, as soon as we get off the phone here. But
well, I'll think of it before we get off the phone. That's Mary McCoy. I've got a good friend that works there.
Yeah. Anyway. Yep, that's the station. They get out about 35 good miles, and but they're far enough out of Houston. But I think Barry will make it back into the big markets again because
it's
60 years old.
It's a Class A, and so they don't cover the city. It's just a little
A. Yeah, T3.
I think it's an A. I think it's 6,000 watt A at 300 feet. Anyway, so how did you get them to hire you at this station? How did you because you walked in, you were a blind person. They'd never had a blind person before.
I had a good air check tape because by then, you know, I had really been on the radio from 79 to 83. I'd had 4 good years. And plus, I worked at an ice skating rink, and I treated the ice skating rink like a radio station.
Yeah.
I was very tight. I did a lot of the things that I did on the radio. I did bits and stuff. The skating people loved me because I would not only play their requests, but I tried to be funny. And I really put a lot of the talent and skills that I had gotten over the past 4 years. I'd really taken those to work with me at the skating rink. So at that point, I'd had 4 continuous years of radio broadcast experience, and I walked in with a good air check tape, and Roger W. Garrett was the PD at that time.
Yeah.
And it just happened, you know, and God puts things in our life for a reason.
Uh-huh.
But I was at the right time, right place, because young Chris Kelly was just leaving, and he was going to go work at an ad agency. Chris was a good talent. He was doing 9 to noon, and I thought he was great. I listened to that whole station just was smoking at that time. And,
uh-huh.
And so Roger said, how would you like to do 9 to noon? He tried me out on the radio first. I had to do, you know, midnight to 6 one night like everybody breaking in.
Yeah.
But he was impressed, and I really gave it my all, tried to sound the best I possibly could because I was eager to get hired there. I thought, man, this is going to be my first commercial break.
Yeah.
Even though I had worked at a lot of stations that sounded like commercial stations, this was the first one. So I immediately got 9 to noon and 7 to midnight Saturday night, kind of a unique setup there. And then I did a lot of production, voicing commercials and things that were my assignment. I got 40 hours. I never got full-time status there, but I worked about 40 hours a week.
Well, they like to keep you. They like to kind of keep you part-time because they don't have to pay insurance and stuff. How did you, when you went there, obviously you had, you even on the midnight to 6 slot, you had to run some commercials. And how did you brailled all the carts, or what did you do?
I did at that time, and a lot of times I used a producer. I actually had somebody that would come in there about 3 times an hour and set me up musically, commercials, and they would help me clean up, and I would pay them, you know, a couple of bucks to hang out and have a good time with me.
Yeah.
They didn't have to stay in the control room with me at all, so a lot of times they were college students who would go out and do their homework, and it was really 30 minutes before I needed their assistance again. In a lot of cases, they could go a good 30 without being in there at all. And so they could run to McDonald's and go get a Coke or whatever, a sandwich. And
so this kept you from having to either tape or braille the log.
Yes. I really kind of took the easy way out on that. Now I don't, because I want to impress people. Plus, I want to, you know, impressing is inspiring to me is what I really mean to say. Inspiration is the key. But I love to be independent now. I'm more independent than I've ever been. But at that time, I enjoyed the, and having somebody around. I enjoyed the company. And I would always pick and choose people that really liked radio, that wanted a break anyway. So they got to be around there and help me do the work. They didn't run the board, but they stacked everything up. Everything was on carts. And we had good cart machines there, too. Nothing ever misfired. So it was fun for them, and it was fun for them to see me work and to run the board. That really challenged them.
Now, were you playing? Were they playing music on carts?
Yes, at K98 we were.
They were playing carted music, and all the commercials, of course, were carted.
Yes.
So you had 6, 2, 3 stacks or something like that, and so all you were doing was playing carts. No records.
They were the nice ITC cart machines. I think they're ITC 99s there or something.
Yeah.
So nothing was aliphase. It just sounded great. And I thought, wow. I remember I used to listen to K98 in the car, and I'd think how good they sound. They really had beefed up the processing before I got there. And so that made it all the more fun. We had a reel-to-reel machine that I would record the telephone calls for contests and phone bit personality. We were allowed to have a couple of personality calls each hour where we'd talk to the listener about whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my real growing spurt in radio. That's where I really got good enough going to KTFM in San Antonio and KTSA.
And once they put you on middays, there was somebody there all the time. You no longer had to pay anybody, right?
Right.
You get
they paid for them.
You could get the. I used to get the girl that typed the log to come in and stack carts for me.
Yep. I did that before too at KODZ here in Dallas. They used to come in and because they were glad how independent we were. You know, at first they'd be nervous, like, wow, am I going to have to punch the buttons? Am I going to have to? And these are people, with no radio experience at all other than just being around the station. So I used to hear a nervousness there. And then as soon as they would visit with me for 10 minutes and see what I did, they're like, this is fun. I like this.
Okay, so you stayed at this Austin station for a while. What was its sister AM? Did it have an AM or just...
We had Kixel, KIXL 970 at that time, Dick Oppenheimer owned, but they were across town.
Daytimer.
Their facility was not with ours.
It was a daytimer, too, at that time.
At that time, yeah, then they went day and night. In 1984, they did. Pretty good nighttime signal, too.
There's
1,000 watts day and night, directional at night. So I'm surprised that they didn't get that. You know, the FCC's been kind of funny about all that because there's a lot of stations that could have had nighttime privilege back in the 60s and 70s and could have done quite well in the marketplace at that point. But now they're giving AM stations all this extra power, and it's too late.
It's a little late for AM, folks.
Yeah.
So you stayed at this Austin station, and did you get an offer from San Antonio, or how did you end up in San Antonio?
Well, I listened to KTSA pretty often because at that time especially you could really get them loud and proud in Austin. And I thought, man, it sure would be fun to work on 550. At that time, KTSA was Bruce Hathaway in the morning, a real fun person who I ended up getting to work with. Ricky Ware, everybody knows who Ricky Ware is. He's been around forever. Still is at KTSA,
in
fact.
He's still there doing talk. It was a year ago. A year ago, I heard him in the afternoons doing talk. I heard Ricky Ware in his early days when he was at Baytown in 55 years ago. And he was at KTBC in Austin for a while.
Yeah. Yep,
and
sure was.
Then he ended up in San Antonio.
Channel 7 news anchor for a little while. I know that he did that. And so Ricky's had quite a 50-year radio career. The guy is about 69 years old now. And
but he's been at KTSA forever. I mean, he's been there long.
Off and on since 1982. But pretty much on. Well, pretty much on that whole time.
He went over and did country on somebody's radio station for a year or so, and then went back to KTSA.
Yeah, he was at K-Buck, and in fact, when he worked with Judd Ashmore at K-Buck, they had a fantastic show that was number one. It went to number one, which was very unique for a country station to do that well. But they were so controversial, and they played such opposites of each other. They completely tried to be opposites, and that helped them to succeed and do better than ever.
You've proved it now. You're a real radio guy, because I knew about K-Buck, and I knew about Judd Ashmore. He used to do weather on one of the TV stations.
Yeah, and I like Judd, and they finally retired him. But he's another guy that had a probably close to 50-year radio career, if not 50.
And they put them together on this little AM 1310 K-Buck, and it was just phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. They were complete opposites of each other on purpose. They would argue about everything. They'd get into heated arguments on the radio. And that wasn't very common back in 1982, really. It is now.
Nowadays it is.
It makes for good radio and TV with Bill O'Reilly. You know, he's always trying to argue to create that sound, you know. To get people to listen. And I do, I have to admit. But
I hate it. It's not radio. It stinks. It's terrible. It's not radio. Come on, let's talk like this again on the radio. Hey, you know, I guess.
Yeah. But KTSA inspired me to want to get down to SA and be in a little bit bigger market.
Yep.
And I wasn't getting anywhere as far as going full-time. I mentioned to you at KHFI, you know, they never hired me full-time.
Yeah.
I thought, what the hey, let's go down to San Antonio and see if we can get on down there. And so here's my first funny story.
All right.
I called Bill Foreman, and he was the program director at KTFM. Nice guy, 32 years old. Went down and met Billy and didn't tell him I was blind before I met him at all. He had no clue that I was blind.
Yeah.
So I went over there kind of looking for his hand to shake his hand, and he picked up, you know, after a couple of minutes, like, hey. But you know what? It really encouraged him because I just had that positive eye of the tiger attitude.
Yeah.
And almost an arrogance about me at that point because I was 19 years old, and I was so confident about myself. And I said, so when do I start, this weekend or next? You know, I just had that attitude. And Bill told me later, he said, you know what, I thought you were pretty cocky, but I liked it.
But he said, that's
one of the reasons I hired you.
But you had one thing in your favor. You were willing to work weekends, and they always, always, always need part-timers.
Oh, yeah, and good part-timers. Yeah. He knew that he could count on me to sound like a full-timer. I'd had experience. I played the K98 air check for him. You know, he wanted to hear that, of course, and I had already recorded several great shows at K98. And so Billy hired me, and I was part-time, and I became full-time. And I had a four-year relationship with Waterman Broadcasting because of that, going in and being arrogant and saying, do I start this weekend or next?
So
I had a suit and tie on that day, so I dressed to impress, and I went in there. And Billy's first question was a great one. He said, hey, what is it going to take for me to help you make this work? You know, and you don't
– Really?
Those kind of employers are still far and few between, and something we haven't talked about yet, but I wrote a book this year called Alicite Living, a Person with Perfect Vision. And I talk about those employers, like Bill Foreman, who are willing to take a gamble on me and make it a win-win partnership. And there's just not, I mean, still I struggle when I'm out of work, which isn't very often, but I have to go through this each and every time I go to a new place and work, because I just can't imagine how I'm going to be able to do it. But then once I show them, they're glad they hired me.
Yeah.
Because I'm inspiring their troops. I'm making their team better because they're seeing a blind guy do something and exceeding quotas, trying to stay in the top 10% of whatever we're doing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, these people say, hey, if Blind Blake can do it, man, I ought to be able to do it. And that's really how they get the feeling. And so it is a win-win for an employer to make that positive investment with their time, because what seems like an obstacle at first ends up being an opportunity.
I did not realize that you had written a book. Tell us a little bit about that, how that came about.
Well, 2 years ago, my Uncle Marvin, who just recently turned 81 years old, said, Blake, something's been on my heart for a long time, and I want to have a serious talk with you about it. And I thought, oh, boy, what is this about? He said, I think that you need to write a book about your life and your careers in radio and working at Bank of America for 7 years and working at Dallas Area Rapid Transit, different things you've done, because all of my jobs have been fairly long tenure for the most part, and I've been a positive example for people. He said, you need to write a book to help people overcome the obstacles and issues in their life. and it will really bless people, and it will also encourage employers to take that win-win gamble from time to time. And so I said, oh, Marvin, you know, I got a couple of stories that I love to tell that I could fill up a couple, maybe two or three chapters.
Yeah.
But there's no way I could fill up a book. Well, I meditated on it a little bit, but I let it go. I didn't, you know, I wrote a couple of stories. I actually got them published, but I still didn't feel the need or desire or the momentum, really, to be able to, you know, zap those chapters together and then make a book out of it. Well, about a year and a half ago, I heard from Frank Holly. He's a guy in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and had a great radio career. I believe he worked at K-Box. I never got to hear his Dallas-Fort Worth work, but the guy's been around. He's a real nice guy, and he knew that I was blind because I write to Jim Rose Remembers Radio a lot. And so Frank Holly knew that I was visually challenged, I guess, or whatever we want to call it. What's politically correct today?
I have no idea. you're just a person without sight.
That's right, Alicite.
Yeah.
And that's why I named the book Alicite Living. I said, yeah, man, I have really had an Alicite life because I've worked hard. But the best part is I was born in a family that made me work hard and had expectations. But this book has really, I noticed, encouraged parents with uniquely challenged children with all different kinds, whether it's muscular dystrophy or whether it's sightlessness or whatever. It's really, you know, given them hope. And so my Uncle Marvin knew that was going to be a reality if I just do it. So Frank Holly, back to him a year and a half ago, said, Blake, I'm writing an article, and I want you to answer a bunch of questions for me. And he had probably 20 good questions, and they were all excellent questions. Before I knew it, Phil, I was writing a book. And I got to thinking about it. I thought, man, you know, and I wrote Frank Holly back, and I emailed him all the answers to his questions. But it inspired me to begin to write. And through about a six-month process, I had 26 chapters, 108 pages down there that really barely needed to be edited. They just needed to be connected better. And so I went ahead and hired Power Publishing up in Indianapolis to assist me in putting it all together and making a book out of it. And Phil, let me know if my phone starts breaking up.
Well, I think you had a few call waitings, but that's all right. We don't worry about those things. Now, this book it's out in hardback or paperback, or how is it distributed?
Well, it's a good-looking paperback, and the reason I say that is I had some good artwork done on it because I really wanted people to want to read the message inside, and people really do judge a book by its cover, and I hate to tell you, it's silly, but it's true. And so if they see some good artwork and they see... you know, my subtitle is really even better than my title. It's called Alicite Living, A Sightless Man with Perfect Vision is my subtitle. And that really says it all because I've got a lot of vision even though I'm totally blind in both eyes.
Yeah.
I got the I can attitude because I grew up in that environment. And I met people, you know, at Crisco Rehabilitation when I got there. I met people like myself who were exposed to that positive peer pressure and who were succeeders, and then I met those who couldn't even boil an egg at that point in their life.
Yeah.
And it varies from parenting, and so that's another reason I wanted to write this book, and I know that Uncle Marvin felt this way too, is positive parenting is the key, you know, to all the success in just about every situation in my life. And so I wrote it for parents primarily, you know, again, with uniquely challenged children, to give them hope to, you know, that their kid was going to be all right, and to put the positive pressure on them to succeed and be go-doers and go-givers.
Now, has this book been read for APH yet?
Not yet. I don't have an audio. I talked to Steve Cumming about it, and we're getting together on it here real soon. I just got it published in early November. You know, when I actually got the shipment of books in, I ordered 1,000 books. I've got $11,000 wrapped up into this project, and so now I'm just trying to retrieve my money initially.
Yeah.
But on the second printing, I'm going to make just a couple of additions, and it's going to be a lot cheaper because the book itself is already done, and I just need to, at that point, I'm going to get to be in Barnes & Noble and some other vendors that, of course, want to make, you know, 50% profit. Right now, I don't have the profit margin for them to work with because I have so much invested.
Well, it would be nice if we could figure out a way for you to read it for APH.
Well, I'd like to, and I could paraphrase it. It would take me, I've got a full-time job currently, and so it would take more time than I've really got to read it word for word, but I own the rights, you know, since I paid the $11,000 and everything, so yeah. I mean, I'd be willing to paraphrase the book, meaning that it would be almost accurate. Obviously, I know every chapter front and back, and you know, I can tell the stories, but it's not going to be word
for word. What if someone translated it to Braille? I mean, that's easily done now.
I'm a good Braille reader, but I'm not. I'm not a good rip and read person, as we used to say in the radio news business.
I don't understand.
Being able to rip off the teletype and just read it, bada bing. I'm not one of those. I have to kind of study a little bit, and then I can read it as fast as I'm talking now.
Yeah.
But initially, it's really it would be, you know, probably a 3-month process for me if I could devote my dedication to that.
So that
project without working anywhere else, I could knock it out in 2 or 3 months.
That would take a good while. All right, let's talk just a minute. You said you couldn't kill an hour. Well, you're just about to. You alluded to the fact that you worked for Bank of America. What did you say?
Yes, I worked there.
What did you do for them?
And it was interesting because I had been working at K-Love at that time, and I had been let go because of budget cuts. And I thought, man, there's got to be something else I can do besides my love, and that was radio. I really thought that was going to be the career that would sustain me my whole life, but I realized that there were rocky roads, and at that time in the early 90s, people were beginning to change formats all the time, and they would let the staff go, it seemed like, more often than not. Every 18 months, I was looking for a new job. I guess
it's always
where I'm going
like
with this.
It's always been like that. That isn't new.
Well, I really discovered it. I finally, you know, I wanted to throw in the towel on a full-time level of radio and just do it part-time for fun. And so I went to a place called Project Link here in Dallas, Texas. And at that time, I'm trying to remember Bill's last name, but I had a good friend who was excellent at helping blind people like myself with good skills to find work. He was the most gung-ho guy. He passed away a few years ago. And this guy was just phenomenal. So I went in and I showed him my resume. And he said, man, all I need you to do is come speak at this panel discussion. You're going to have Southwest Airlines there. You're going to have a lot of people there. Tell them what you want to do and really, really get up there and, you know, say a lot of good stuff in 5 minutes. Well, I was ready to rock and roll. I went to this, it was over at the headquarters of Southwest Airlines, and Bank of America, formerly Nations Bank, happened to be there. And I told them how much I'd love to do customer service because I was a people person, a good communicator, and a good salesperson at a customer service level. And anyway, I was convincing, and at that time, no blind people had ever done customer service. They did. Nations Bank was a blind person employer. They did have some blind people doing a variety of things, but nothing in the call centers. And so I got an opportunity there, which ended up being a 7-year opportunity to really shine in the workplace until they moved their call center out of the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and I was going to have to either move to Wichita, Kansas, or Rio Rancho, California, if I wanted to keep my job. And I wanted to keep my job, but I wasn't willing to move to either one of those two places because I knew nobody.
Yeah.
And I didn't know about my opportunities in radio because at that time I was working full part-time, very consistent part-time at Kiss FM, and I was making a lot of extra money and doing what I wanted to do. I got to fill in for Kid Craddock a couple of weeks a year. So there were different things I was getting to do that I wanted to. And I was also dating the lady that I ended up marrying at that time. That was another huge reason that I didn't want to move. So Bank of America was my first opportunity to get out there and get out of my comfort zone and how to do something completely different that I didn't really care about that much until I got there, and it began to be fun. But it was, you know, probably 3 months before it was any fun at all. And so that's why I encourage everybody to occasionally get out of that comfort zone, man, and make a difference in another type of workplace.
What was the other job that you alluded to, Bank of America? Then what did you do after?
After Bank of America, I went to Dallas Area Rapid Transit, as we call DART.
Okay.
D-A-R-T.
Yeah.
And I did customer service there with trip scheduling. I did not work for Paratransit. A lot of people get confused on that, but I worked for the regular buses and light rail and the TRE train, which is the Dallas to Fort Worth train that's a regular train. And so that was a hoot because, once again, I got to inspire people in the brand-new workplace. I went from a call center of 500 people at Bank of America to a call center of 50 people at DART. And so I got to really know about all those 50 people, and it was a real encouragement for them because I learned the adaptive technology. I could not have done either one of these two jobs 50 years ago. Adaptive technology did not provide this opportunity until about 15 years ago.
That's right.
So, man, adaptive technology. If you're going blind, if any of your listeners are going blind, I know this sounds ridiculously silly to say, But the time to go blind is now because modifications are in our favor.
That is so funny because our little buzz phrase that we talk about is, if you got to be blind, this is a great time to do it.
Yep.
And that's true. If you got to be blind, it's wonderful now because we can do so. Computer opened up so many things. We're getting very close to the end here. What are you doing? You said you had a full-time job now. What are you doing now?
I work for Zig Ziglar Corporation in sales, and I also MC the podcast. We have a Ziglar Inspire podcast at Ziglar.com.
Okay.
That's spelled Ziglar.com.
Okay.
Zig Ziglar is a positive motivator who just turned 80 years old. He's been a positive motivator for more than 40 years, and he is a phenomenon. And this guy, I mean, everybody knows who he is, but he actually walks the talk. I don't know if you've heard the expression, you can talk the talk, but can you walk the talk? This guy is the real deal. And he hired me 7 months ago to do some sales for him. And I'm having a blast over there with the podcast especially. The sales, sometimes I like it, sometimes it's one of those victories that you feel great when you get a sale, but I'm doing a lot of telemarketing sales, and I think that's become a thing of the past. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to get right through to the contact people, even on the first three tries a lot of times. You're having difficulty, so sales is coming a little bit more difficult to me in that regard because it's not customer service. It's actually calling and trying to make that cold call a cool call and then a warm call and all that.
Okay, but you're out of radio now.
I'm out of radio except for my voice production business. I'm the image voice for three radio stations currently, including KEOM in Mesquite, Dallas, Fort Worth.
Uh-huh.
It's called Blazin' Blake Productions. That's Blazin Blake, Blake, of course. And BlakeLindsey.com is my website if anybody wants to go check that out.
BlakeLindsey.com.
And that's spelled L-I-N-D-S-A-Y.
Okay.
Uniquely, so I want to make sure people know that. But that has a lot of my voice work. BlakeLindsey.com does. And I'm just mainly doing it for fun. I don't make a lot of money at it. I've got three radio stations currently. I'm doing a lot of advertisements as well, especially during the holidays. I get pretty busy. I am able to do that from home with the blind-friendly studio like you have one at your house, Phil.
Like we're doing right now.
Yep, you can operate well, and I can tell you're good at what you do. And so I'm doing this mainly from my bedroom.
All right.
That's where I do my production because I've got a one-bedroom apartment for my wife and I to live in. So I just shut the door and get busy in here, and I have a blast doing radio stations.
Here's a guy who couldn't kill an hour, but we've done it.
Okay.
We've killed an hour. Blake Lindsey has been our guest, and that's Blake Lindsey. Spell the Lindsey one more time.
L-I-N-D-S-A-Y. BlakeLindsey.com.
BlakeLindsey.com.
And there's an email link there, and I'd love to hear from you.
Thank you, Blake. Hold on just a second.